personal finance. Shit's about to get real. Cashflow King with you today. And today in episode 23, the passive real estate investing miniseries, Turnkey Rentals. Thanks for checking out the show. Shout out to all of our listeners as our numbers continue to grow. Somebody sent me a text today, and it was something along the lines of best passive income ideas for 2022 or something like that. One of those, you know, BS headlines that you see out there. And I was going through it, and one of the items in there talked about drop shipping, and I had a good chuckle. I said, you know, I should get some gear for Real Talk Personal Finance podcast and drop ship that and see how that goes. So who knows? We might come out with some gear for you in the future. And maybe you can pick your favorite person on the podcast, whether that's the Cashflow King, Cube Crusher, Travel Queen. We got O-Dog coming up. We'll have different guests throughout time, and maybe we'll come out with some merch or some gear. It seems to be the cool thing to do these days, and you can show your support for the show because we have not come out with the premium version yet for the cost of a chicken bake, which, by the way, finally went up at Costco. Can you believe that shit? Inflation is finally hitting everywhere. So anyway, today's episode on turnkey rentals, that's what we're going to cover. Hopefully you caught the last episode on the introduction to the passive real estate investing miniseries. We went through several different items, one of which was active real estate investing versus passive real estate investing, kind of did a broad overview, talked about your real estate related team and all sorts of things along those lines. Today, we're going to do a deeper dive into turnkey rentals. And I thought to start it off here, let's just define turnkey because it's going to mean very different things to different people. So when we talk about turnkey investing, and there's different types of turnkey investments that we'll touch on throughout the show, but primarily we're going to be talking about single family homes. There's some operators that will do multifamily. So you may have a duplex, you may have a fourplex or a triplex, but generally speaking, most turnkey providers out there are going to be offering single family homes for rent. That's primarily what we're going to focus on today. So first, if we define turnkey, what are the different types of turnkey companies or turnkey operators, or what the hell do we mean when you say the word turnkey out there? And everybody has a slightly different definition. So first is going to be my favorite, which is going to be a fully integrated turnkey company. That means that this is an organization that has an acquisitions team typically. They're going to go out, they're going to find the property, they're going to secure the property, they are going to rehab the property, they're going to screen and place a tenant into the property, they're going to then turn around and sell that to you as the individual investor, and then they're also going to put it under their management company, underneath their parent company. Usually they'll have a separate management division for professional property management. So a fully integrated company from the acquisition to the rehabilitation to the tenant screening and placement, and then ultimately management. That, in my opinion, and there's very few companies out there that do all of this, but there are several. In my opinion, if you're going to look at turnkey real estate investing of any kind, that is the type of operation that you typically want to align yourself with. And for the majority of my rentals, that's exactly what I've done. And we'll talk a little bit about some other things I've done and how that's worked out also. So first is the fully integrated turnkey company. Everything is under one roof, okay? Next is going to be a turnkey company that outsources the property management but does all the other stuff. So they're still going to have the acquisitions folks. They're still going to put the property under contract. They're typically going to go ahead and rehab it. They're going to sell it to you as the individual investor. But once that transaction's closed, that's it. You are now essentially offloaded to a third-party property management company. They're done with you. They made their money on the flip, and they, quite frankly, I mean, the good ones will say that they do, and maybe they do, but in all reality, they don't give a shit what happens to you afterwards, because once you close escrow, they've made their money. They have no further involvement with the property. That's basically passed on and along to somebody else. And there's a lot of companies out there that sort of imply, and you got to really be careful about the language. When I first started investing in real estate, and I've only been doing it maybe for a half a dozen years or so not entirely all that long, but you know, for several years now. And when I was relatively new, I think this was actually the fourth house that I bought, I've been working with one company in particular, and we're going to talk about due diligence and how to look for companies and stuff coming up here. But before we get into that, I had dealt with one company in particular, and I'm not going to name any names on the show because, like I said, I don't like to promote other people, other organizations, except for Costco. So we'll just kind of keep that as is. But this other company that I was buying with, that's who I had my rentals with up until that point. And then I was looking to purchase more. And the time frame with the initial company that I was working with, the initial fully integrated turnkey operator, they had a wait list and things kind of slowed down a little bit. And I was kind of anxious and I wanted to buy something else. So I started exploring and looking at other companies. Well, I didn't realize this sort of until the middle of the transaction. However, this other company portrayed that they were a fully integrated turnkey company. And for the most part, I guess you can make the argument that they were, with the exception of that last part I mentioned where the third-party property management is outsourced. But they make it sound kind of like they do it. There's some key phrases. If you really decipher and dissect what they're saying, you can pretty much tell that they're going to offload it. But when you're relatively new and they're talking to you about property management and then, you know, different things like that, and they kind of say certain things that almost imply that they're going to be doing it, but they don't explicitly and specifically state that they're going to be doing it. And then you find out, oh, well, actually, we have a special agreement with this other third-party property management company, and you're going to get a little bit better pricing in terms of the percentage of gross rents that they charge you, and you're going to get a little extra special treatment because we send a lot of people to them, and they try to gloss over it, and, you know, it is what it is, but you got to watch out for that. So this was a house that I bought from a turnkey, quote unquote, company, but then they had third-party property management. And it's worked out okay for the most part, although I did have some issues with the HVAC in the first year. I think I had like $1,100 in repairs. And even after bringing that to their attention afterwards, they really weren't willing to do anything about it. In fact, they wanted to sell me another house. And, you know, I kind of talked to them a little bit and tried to negotiate, well, if I did buy another house from you, you know, are you going to waive the initial tenant placement fee and things like that, just to kind of see how much I could push, because they weren't willing to do anything about the HVAC issues that happened in the first year. And generally, that's not going to happen. There's some companies out there that will offer sort of a guarantee. There's one in particular that I work with that offers a 1-year guarantee. So if anything goes wrong from a standpoint of maintenance, if I had bought that house from that other fully integrated company, it would have been covered, no questions asked, $0 out of pocket, no deductibles, no trip charges, no nothing. It would have been fixed. And so I got burned a little bit on that one, but I still own that house to this day. It's performing very, very well. And, you know, everything else about it was fine, but you will hit some hiccups and snags. So that's the second type of company. First was a fully integrated turnkey company, including property management that's in-house. And then the second type was a turnkey company that has third-party property management where the property management function is outsourced and they may or may not have a deal, quote unquote, or a special agreement or arrangement with another third-party property management company. The next one are promoters. And promoters come in different forms. So a promoter is basically a person or an organization that kind of talks a lot about turnkey and getting everybody all jazzed up about it. And, you know, we work with the best providers and we're going to help you do this, that, and the other thing. They generally do not actually own the property. They're simply going to put you in touch with a provider that does. It's essentially a glorified referral source. And so there's nothing inherently wrong with that. But again, you have to be careful because there's some promoters that provide value. So there's some of them that have really good reputations. They work with a number of different providers in a number of different markets, and they can help a beginning investor from start to finish from that first phone call about what is turnkey investing and why would I consider investing in a single family home to rent out to somebody else? And what does that look like? What does the financing look like? How does this whole thing work? And they kind of can hold your hand throughout the process, answer questions, coach you a little bit on different ways to, you know, as far as the financing, how do you want to structure your financing, things like that. And they can provide some value. They end up getting a referral fee on the back end from the provider themselves for sending you to that provider. And some of those companies out there, some of those promoters, they earn that fee. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's other ones that just try to make a quick buck. They don't provide any value. They don't offer any coaching or anything like that to help you. It's simply to get you all excited, pass you off to the company and then collect their check on the back end, and they really don't seem to give a shit what happens to you afterwards. And I almost got caught up in that in the beginning. Thankfully, I didn't fall for it. Again, not to say you should never go with a promoter. You do whatever you'd like. But if you are going to go with a promoter to work with a turnkey outfit, you want to make sure that you're going with one that actually adds value. And by the way, it typically does not cost anything to you up front to work with a promoter. They make their money on the back end from that referral fee that they earn from the turnkey provider themselves. So it's truly up to you. For some people, if you're brand new, if you're looking to be in multiple markets, if you want to know that if something does go wrong, you have a promoter that will stand behind you to actually go back at that turnkey company, almost as like an intermediary that has some leverage because they have so many investors that they send their way to get stuff fixed and to do it right, you know, it could be worth it for you to go that route. Again, personally, I've not done that, but I've definitely seen the difference over the years in terms of how these promoters operate. And there's all kinds of reviews and stuff out there. If you really dig hard enough, you can find, you know, which companies you may want to stay away from, which ones seem to be good. Again, I'm not going to name anybody on the show. That's for you to do your own due diligence on. So those are kind of the three, I guess, main categories or types of providers. You got number one, a fully integrated turnkey company with in-house property management. That's my favorite. Number two, you got a turnkey operator that outsources and has third-party property management. Okay, that's not as good in my opinion, but it's okay. Then you have number three, the promoters, and some add value, some don't, and they're pretty much going to refer you to a provider. And again, last thing I'll say on the promoters is that they could be referring you to either number one or number two, right? They could refer you to a company that's fully integrated and you're good to go. But they could also refer you to a turnkey company that has third-party property management. So now you're dealing with the promoter. The promoter's referring you to the turnkey company. And then once they're done flipping the house and selling it to you, they're then passing you off to their third-party property management company, which again, might be okay, but I feel like the more links you put in the chain, the weaker the chain can become. So that's just something to be aware of and something you want to be thinking about if you're considering in doing any type of turnkey rental real estate investing. So we talked on the last show, why turnkey? For me personally, I don't want a second job, right? I want something that is fairly passive, and we'll go through different ways to look at returns here in a little bit, but I want something that's fairly passive, that can build wealth over time, that's non-correlated to the stock market. All the things I talked about on the last episode, I don't want a second job. Does that mean that you should or shouldn't go with turnkey? I don't know. That's up to you and your situation. Some people, if they have a lot of time and they want to get their hands dirty and they have that skill set and they want to take a more active role, then turnkey is probably not for them. But if you're a busy W-2 professional, you're a busy small business owner, or you're just fucking lazy and don't want to do anything, you can certainly consider turnkey investing if that's something that makes sense for you. With turnkey, you will have direct ownership of the property. Now, how you take that ownership is up to you. You want to consult with your own, again, real estate related team, your legal advisor, your tax advisor, maybe even your financial advisor, on what makes the most sense in terms of how you want to take title to the property, whether that is in your own name, whether that's in some type of entity, whether that's with a partner, whatever that looks like for you, that's beyond the scope of today's show. But either way, no matter how you slice it, you have direct ownership, which gives you more control, right? You can decide now that you own that property, do you want to sell or not? And when do you want to sell? Do you want to refinance or not? And when do you want to refinance? Do you want to hold it forever? Like whatever you want to do, you have a lot more control there. We'll talk in the upcoming episodes about funds and syndications and some of the lack of control that you might have in some of those other types of investments. And they all have their pros and cons. But for turnkey rentals specifically, with direct ownership, you do have more control. And I'll give you an example of how this came to fruition for me. With my turnkey rentals, let's just say I made a decision to take several individual rentals that each had their own mortgage on each of those properties and essentially do what's called cross-collateralization. So I cross-collateralized the portfolio. In other words, each mortgage was attached to one property. And instead, I decided to go out and get a commercial loan, which I had to personally guarantee. But I got a commercial loan under my business, my LLC, and cross-collateralized the portfolio, got one loan with a much lower fixed interest rate for 30 years. I pulled all my cash out in the process, which is called a cash out refinance, And now all of those properties are under one commercial loan with a personal guarantee. I got all my money out, down payment, closing costs, and so forth. I still maintain control of the properties. I have them under one loan, which makes things administratively a little bit easier, and was able to take the cash out proceeds and redeploy those into other real estate related investments. And in the meantime, the properties themselves, because the rate was that much better and rents have gone up over time as they tend to do, was able to maintain the same cash flow. In fact, the cash flow overall, depending on how you look at it, is actually further ahead. So technically, when I did the transaction, I think I lost maybe $200-$300 a month in cash flow. But then when I redeployed those cash out refinance proceeds, that more than made up for that and then some. And in the process, the rents on those houses themselves had gone up. So I'm many dollars ahead now versus where I would have been. But the point of me bringing that up is not to brag, but to say that because I had direct ownership of the properties, I had more control and I had the ability to make that decision. I was not relying on another party to make the decision on whether or not to refinance and when to refinance and what type of debt financing that they're going to use. I was able to make all those decisions, which was kind of nice. Next, I want to talk about due diligence. This is something that I think very often gets overlooked. So when I was first getting started, before I made any investments and with any turnkey providers, I went and took the time to tour with several different turnkey providers. I wanted to meet them in person, see their office, see their team, take a tour of the properties, see the quality of work that they do, and just have a chance to interact with them in person. Because no matter how many phone calls or emails or, you know, you going through their website or whatever, you're never really going to get the same sense that you can get by seeing them in person. It's kind of like the same thing now where everything's virtual and you're on, you know, this virtual meeting or that virtual meeting versus being somewhere in person. There's just, you know, there's pros and cons to everything, but it's just a little bit different. So I took the time to do that, and it's going to cost you some money to do that. You know, some providers, I know there's one in particular that will say, hey, if you fly out to see us and you end up buying a property with us, we'll cover your travel expenses up to a certain amount of money. There's other ones that will say, hey, if you want to come here, you got to come on your own dime, but you know, we'll throw you some gift cards for lunch. Some of them will even take you out to lunch. Just depends on the provider, the market, you know, what's common, how they operate their business. They're all going to function a little bit differently. But most of them know that if they do a good job and they can entice you to buy with them once, you're probably going to buy with them repeatedly. And that's, you know, what drives their business forward ultimately. So anyway, I went and I toured with several different providers, and there was everything from just completely blown away at the operation, which needless to say, that's the company that I do the majority of my turnkey rentals with. There was a company that was just terrible. They were really nice people, but they had like awful communication. We actually walked a property with some other investors. They had a garage. There was water in the garage. There was no tenant in there. They had no idea. They had to call it into the main office while we were there on the tour. That's the type of shit you're never going to get to find out about if you're just doing your due diligence from behind a computer screen, right? Or over the phone. So you kind of have to get out there and see it, right? There's other ones where we walked in and just the houses that they were buying were pretty awful. The neighborhoods were not as advertised, you know, on their website. The contractors that they were using, I mean, you know, you're never going to find a contractor in a fucking tux, nor do you expect to, but there were some pretty rough characters doing some work in there, smoking inside the house, just shoddy type of work. Really wasn't impressed with that operation at all. And so you're going to see all kinds of stuff out there as far as that goes. But I really do think that there's no substitute for going out and doing the investor tour in person. Now, with that said, does that mean that you need to go out to that particular market, especially if it's a market outside your home state, for example, if you're in the US, do you actually need to go out there and visit all the properties and step foot in the properties and do the punch list before you close? No, you don't. You certainly could. Virtually nobody does. And I can say, although I've done the tours in person, I've met the operators in person, I've toured actual properties that are in different phases of the rehab that they do and they offer, I've done that in person, I have never stepped foot into any of my turnkey rental properties. And I know that sounds crazy. If you would have said to me 10 years ago that I would have been buying homes without ever stepping foot in those homes, and I would tell you that you're crazy, right? But it does work. And I just want to, again, meet the provider, trust them, trust the process, see their quality of work in general, and basically just go with the understanding that the other homes that they produce and that they work on are more than likely going to be of the same quality. Now, we'll talk about inspections in a little bit. You always get an inspection, so I'm not saying to not do that, but I'm just saying about making a special trip out there for every single property. Very few investors actually do that. Very few investors actually go out and meet the operators before buying with them. I think that's a colossal mistake, but again, that's for you to decide in terms of whether or not you think that makes sense for you to do. But I would strongly recommend that. And there were several companies that I did not and will not do business with as a result of those tours. Does it cost you a little bit of money? Sure. Would it be a lot more expensive if you had one or multiple properties with them after the fact, only to find out that they're not delivering as promised? That would be a much bigger mistake and a much more costly mistake than spending a few hundred bucks in a couple days or whatever to go out there and take the tour. It's not like you have to be out there for a week. You might choose to extend your trip, talk to your CPA on strategies on how to potentially deduct certain types of trips. And there's all kinds of things around that. We don't give tax or legal or financial or any fucking advice on the show. That's our disclaimer. Do your own due diligence. However, there might be some ways to strategically structure your trips in such a way that you have some business, also some personal stuff, and you might be able to deduct at least a portion of it. So that's the due diligence part. You also want to, again, see their operations. You want to ask them about a whole host of things, and there's checklists out there. I did not prepare one for the show, but as far as their operations go, specifically with regards to property management, you want to ask a lot of questions. There's all types of things that you want to be thinking about. The cheapest or lowest cost is not always going to be the best. So a lot of times people ask me all the time, well, how much do you pay your property management company? Well, I work with a couple of them and they're structured a little bit differently. And here's what one does and here's what the other one does. And the pricing is kind of sort of similar, but you know, they all have tendencies to do things in a certain way. There's different ways that they make their money, but you want to be aware of that as you're doing your own analysis, which I'm about to talk about here in a second. All right, wait lists. Some turnkey outfits will have a waiting list. For some of them, they will not. And that doesn't necessarily mean the ones that have the wait lists are good and the ones that don't are bad necessarily. But generally speaking, if there is a company that has a wait list, they probably have a wait list for a reason. And so that typically means that other investors are wanting to do business with them, that they have a good track record, and they have people pretty much lined out the door to do deals with them. And that's great. But doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't go with a company that does not have a wait list. But you want to keep that in mind as far as your time frame goes in terms of when you might be looking to get involved with something like this. So if you have a company that has a 6 month, 1 year, 2 year wait list, well, and you just want to get started, unfortunately, it is what it is. You may have to go with another provider, or you may have to look at another type of investing out there. We'll talk about syndications on the next couple episodes. So there's, you know, something for everybody, but that is something that's become more and more common, especially the way the market has been and inventory tightening up, supply and demand issues. They're having a hard time, a lot of these providers, getting inventory at, you know, reasonable pricing, and pricing in general has gone up. Mortgage rates have gone up. So if you've never invested in turnkey real estate before, rentals, I'm not saying you should or shouldn't do anything, but this may not be the time to jump in on the one hand, because the margins are very tight. The deals are very tight. I just bought a deal not too long ago that, quite frankly, normally would not fit my buy box, and I generally would not have purchased it. When I put it into my overall passive income portfolio, it works just fine. If that was my first and only investment and somebody came to me and said, hey, Cashflow King, would you do this deal? My answer would probably be no, but I found a way to do it creatively. And I think long-term, and I'm trying to play the long game, if I look out 10, 15, 20 years from now, I think it'll be a home run. And I'll look back and say, what were you worried about? But at the same time, again, and I don't say this to brag, but you got to make sure you have a solid financial foundation. And if that particular deal doesn't do what it's supposed to do or just completely fumbles, it's not going to bring down the empire, so to speak. So, you know, it's going to be fine. But if that were the first deal, I probably wouldn't have done it. So I say all that to say, if you're listening to this podcast and you've never invested in turnkey real estate and you're interested in it, certainly explore it. Just tread with caution and really take a look to see how it fits into your overall financial plan before you make any decisions. You don't want to make a decision just for the sake of doing it and getting involved and getting some momentum only to have it cripple you. You know, you might not score a home run right now, but you know, if you're wanting to get started and it makes sense in the context of your situation, go for it. But if you're walking on, you know, eggshells, so to speak, financially, and the deal is mediocre, you probably shouldn't do it, right? And again, that's your decision to make. All right, next is the analysis. I will say that Everyone will do this differently. You should almost never strictly use the numbers that you see on a pro forma from the turnkey company because they're going to look more favorable than they actually are. Their goal is to sell you a property, right? They want to sell you a property. They want to put it under their management. They want to look as good as they possibly can to get you interested in making that purchase. And that's great, but you always should use your own numbers. So I've seen, for example, and every market is going to be different. So there's no one magic number to use for this. But I've seen providers that either don't put anything for vacancy, right? So the property at some point will probably become vacant. You will have a tenant that moves out. You may, unfortunately, at some point in time, have a tenant that needs to be evicted. You may have a period of time where the property is being turned over and there's nobody in there paying rent. You're going to have vacancy loss. So to have a pro forma that has nothing allotted for that, I think is financial suicide and is very irresponsible on the part of the provider. But you, as the individual investor, need to know that that's something that you should factor into your underwriting, right? As you're looking at the numbers, you want to have a vacancy factor. And everyone is going to use something different. I've seen some providers that use something very small, like a 2 or 3%. Again, I think they're kidding themselves. I've seen some providers use 5%. I think that's starting to approach more reasonable. Personally, when I run my numbers, I use 8%. I've seen some people use 10%. And you might say, why the hell would you use 8%? Did you just pull that out of your ass, Cashflow King? Well, yeah, kind of. But no, really, the reason is that 8% is approximately 1 month per year, okay? So with the operators that I work with, and again, they're a little bit different, turnkey providers that I'm with, but there's going to be turnover costs. So if I have a tenant in there, say for 3 years, and then they move out, okay, I'm going to have to pay to turn the property. They're going to go in, they're going to fix, you know, the loose fucking faucet. They're going to slap some paint on there. They're going to clean it up. They're going to make sure it doesn't smell like dog piss. Like, they're going to do all the things they need to do to get it up to standard for the next tenant, right? And you, as the property owner, have to pay for that. So that those are costs that you might not experience them every single year. Like I said, in that example, you might have somebody in there for 3 years. However, after that, and you budgeted 1 month per year, but after, once they moved out, you're going to have to pay the turnover costs. Some companies, if your tenants renew the lease, let's say you have a 1 year lease and they renew. I have one company that I work with. They don't charge me anything for that. Nothing. I have another one that I work with. They charge a couple $100 on a renewal. So I'm going to pay them $200 every time somebody renews. Okay. And the way that they look at it is, well, you know, we're doing a good job. If this tenant wants to continue to live here. And generally speaking, we're also going to raise the rent. Some property management companies will say things like, well, we earn our fee, or we earn, you know, when you pay a renewal fee, we try to earn that with a rent increase. And, you know, you're not always going to raise the rents every year. I like to raise them typically every couple of years, but it just depends on the situation and on the market. But anyway, you're going to have certain costs. And so when I use 8% for vacancy, I'm using that for the actual time that there's nobody physically in there, nobody economically in there paying rent. So that's rent loss, right? Plus for the turnover costs. And then also for those where it applies for a lease renewal fee. And I don't really have, I mean, right now I have no vacancies, but obviously the market's on fire pretty much everywhere. But even when you do, they generally fill them pretty quickly. I mean, I have sometimes where they'll be filled in 2 to 3 weeks. And you're going to use that portion of funds that you've essentially budgeted, that 8% per year, to cover and pay for all that stuff. So the point, again, is you want to do your own numbers, but I would use something 8% personally is what I use. You might want to use 10% or 6% or whatever to account for that, okay? And so you're going to have something for vacancy loss. You're also going to want to have something probably for general maintenance, so things are going to break. And like I mentioned, there might be some providers that do some sort of a guarantee. Some might do 6 months, some might do 1 year, some might do nothing. Where if something breaks for the first however long you own the property, they'll take care of it. Otherwise, you're going to be on the hook. And you should pretty much assume that you're going to be on the hook and you don't have a guarantee in place unless they tell you that you specifically have one. So you're going to have that. You're also going to have things like capital expenditures. Well, one of the benefits of turnkey, I don't know if we talked much about this in the beginning of the episode, I probably should have started with this, is that usually it is a full gut. At least that's generally what you want. They're going to put on a new roof. They're going to put on, you know, new HVAC. They're going to update plumbing. They're going to update electrical. They're going to repaint everything. They might put in a new kitchen and a new bathroom and whatever else. They're completely kind of rehabbing that property. That's good. Especially, for example, take the roof. If it's a brand new roof, chances are it's going to last for a long period of time. But eventually, if you own the property long enough, you're going to have to replace that as the property owner. Well, where does that money come from? Does it just fall out of the sky? No. But But if you budget for that and say, all right, I'm going to take a certain percentage every month and call it capital expenditure reserves, because I know over time that we're going to have to replace the roof. And for month after month after month and year after year after year, you're probably not going to have to replace the roof, and that money just accumulates. But eventually, you're going to have to do that, and you want to make sure you have funds available to do that. So that will be a capital expenditure reserve. So you got your vacancy loss, you got your CapEx or capital expenditures, you got your maintenance reserve. You're probably going to be paying a property management company to do this. So you have your PM or property management company fee that's going to be in there. All that should get baked in. If you're financing, you're going to want to put your mortgage payment in there, principal, interest, taxes, insurance. There's a lot of expenses that come out. However, if you do the numbers right, once you net everything out, you make your mortgage payment if you have one, you have your other reserves that come out, anything that's left over, in my opinion, that's what I call free cash flow. And when someone says my property cash flows X dollars per month, that's the number that I'm looking at. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't do it that way, right? A lot of people say, well, the rent's going to be this and the mortgage is that. So rent minus mortgage equals cash flow. And they're just dead wrong. They're lying to themselves. They're kidding themselves as far as that goes. I had a buddy, one of my best friends to this day from college, who would say to me things like, well, why would you invest in rental real estate? I'm not trying to get my cell phone bill paid every month. Because initially, things start off typically really low. When you take all those expenses out, it's like, yeah, that doesn't really excite me, right? That doesn't look all that great, for example. But when you dig a little bit deeper, and we have a bullet point coming up on how to calculate total returns on a rental property, there's more to it than just that. And rents do generally go up over time, and your returns will generally go up over time, depending on which specific return metric we're talking about. For those geeks out there, bear with me for now, because I know technically that there's one specific return type that wouldn't be correct on, but overall, in general, it's going to go up. So anyway, there's a lot to think about there, but the point is, when you're doing the analysis, you can use their numbers or look at their numbers, but I wouldn't fully rely on them. The whole trust but verify, and I would use your own numbers. If they use 3% for vacancy, use 8. If they use 5% for maintenance and CapEx, use 10. Whatever the numbers are, you want to do that for yourself. Property taxes is a big one. A lot of areas, they're going to use a property tax number based upon the most recent assessment from PVA, the Property Value Administration. You want to use your own numbers there. So if they purchase it at a discount and they're rehabbing it and doing all this stuff and the assessed value is way lower, and that's what they're basing their property tax estimate on, and you as the individual investor are purchasing from the turnkey provider at a much higher price after they've improved the property, and the PVA is likely to come back and say, hey, this thing's worth more. We're going to now assess based on this new value, therefore your property taxes are going to increase. Again, you want to account for that. So there's a lot that goes into doing your own numbers. They're probably not going to be perfect. The first time you do it, you might not have any idea. The turnkey provider might try to talk you out of it and saying you're being way too conservative. That's totally up to you. But at the end of the day, this is your money that we're talking about, and you're ultimately going to be on the hook for paying these expenses. So if it were me, I would rather underwrite for that and be too conservative than the opposite, right? Because then you really find yourself up Schitt's Creek without a paddle. Next is sort of the process, right? Every turnkey provider does this a little bit differently. There's some that will simply send you a contract, right? Like, for example, there's one company where you get on a wait list. And they start sending out properties to people once you hit the top of the wait list. And you can do your own due diligence, do your own numbers, research the neighborhood, the zip code. Hopefully you have an idea of what you want before you get to the top of the list. And they start sending them out to you, and you might reply back and say, hey, I want that one. Okay, great. You're the first one to reply. Cool. Here's a contract. And some of them don't require any earnest money, right? You don't have to mail a check at all. You sign the contract, and basically you go through the process. If you're going to get a mortgage on the property, you go through the underwriting process and get with your lender and all that sort of thing. Others will charge earnest money. I had one property that they wanted $5,000 to lock it up. And so I went ahead and sent the check in, signed the contract, sent the check in for the $5,000, and basically the same process. So everywhere's going to work a little bit differently. Obviously, you want to read your contract and be very careful before you sign anything. If you're not sure, again, you might want to consult with your own legal counsel, so on and so forth. As far as the lenders go, this is something that was interesting, but a lot of these providers will only work with certain lenders. So I had a situation where I had used one particular lender for an extended period of time. In the beginning, I had a great experience, and then towards the end, they kind of fell off a fucking cliff and were doing dog shit work, and I didn't want to use them anymore. And so I had another lender that I had used in the meantime for my cash out refinance, and I'm like, hey, I want to use these guys. And they were like, well, sorry, like that's not going to work. And here's the list of approved lenders that we work with. So while they can't make you use one particular lender, at least I don't believe they can, they should always give you a choice. They're generally going to have their own preferred list of lenders that they work with. And they can refuse to sell you the property if you don't want to use one of their lenders. So I did find somebody else on their list and I did use them. I had a great experience and we'll probably use that lender again. But they do have a little bit of control as far as that goes. And the biggest reason for this is they are normally using lenders that are very used to these types of transactions, these type of turnkey rental transactions. They don't want the big banks because there's always something that's going to come up and they usually have no flexibility as far as the way that things need to be done. It's a nightmare to use some of the big banks a lot of the time. And they'll tell you story after story after story about how investors essentially ended up not being able to purchase properties because they tried to use and insisted on using their own big box lender, only come to find out they couldn't close the transaction. So if your provider has a list that they work with, again, do your due diligence. You can ask for referrals. You can check out different ones. You can try to put them up against each other and get a good faith estimate or a rate sheet if you want from a couple of them and see where the pricing is. But the way I normally like to do it is just develop a relationship with a particular lender unless and until they give you a reason to go elsewhere, which unfortunately happened to me where they just turned out to be kind of their customer service. They had a lot of people leave and it just went completely downhill and was dog shit at the end. And so I try to refer somebody to them and they dropped the ball. I did another refi with them and it took way too long and their customer service, like I said, was just shit. So I went elsewhere. But if you can develop a relationship with a lender and their terms are fair and everybody's happy, I think that is normally the way to go. At least that's the way I like to do things until they give me a reason not to. All right. So I mentioned this a few minutes ago as far as the inspection. Always, I don't care what anybody tells you, this is one thing I will tell you. My advice, I said it, always get a home inspection. And I would strongly encourage you to get a home inspection from your own home inspector, okay? And you can get a referral to this person, but there are some turnkey providers out there that will say, well, we have so-and-so or we have this company and they've already gone through and done an inspection and here it is. Well, who's hiring that inspector? The turnkey provider. That's not what you want. You want to hire your own independent home inspector that works for you, that you are paying to go and find things. And I can tell you, I bought many houses now, every single time the inspection has more than paid for itself. I don't know how the person that I'm using does it at the pricing that he does it at. And it's funny because I just bought a home and the price, I mean, it was a little bit smaller of a home and he does base it partly on square footage, but it was actually less than what I've paid for some of the other inspections that he's done for me. Maybe he just likes repeat business and he knows I'm, quick to pay and all that kind of shit. But anyway, for the price of that inspection, I ended up getting a brand new furnace in this particular property. Now, you might say, well, if it's a turnkey property, aren't they supposed to be doing all that anyway? A lot of companies now are doing sort of a turnkey light type of approach or a 2.0, turnkey 2.0 or 2.0 turnkey or whatever the hell you want to call it now, where they are still doing the vast majority of things, but if there's some things that still have some life, some useful life left in them, they will not replace that and supposedly will discount the price of the property accordingly, which is fine. In this particular home that I bought was probably the first, maybe the second, because one was from another group, but anyway, the first one from this particular group that was of this nature, where not every single thing was replaced. And so there were some components that were a little bit older. However, when the home inspector went through, he found that one, in this particular case, the furnace was about, I think it was 8 years older than they had told me that it was. And the rest of the related components were correct, but it was just a mistake for the rehab coordinator where they grouped everything with the same year. And it turns out that the furnace was actually from 2008 as opposed to, I think it was 2016 or something like that. So they put in a brand new furnace for me. And there was some other shit that the inspection came back with and they fixed all that. And they were really great about it. Literally, you get the inspection and every group's different. Some of them may not fix shit, but if it's truly going to be turnkey, you want it rehabbed, ready to go, and a tenant in place. And I swear, this tenant that lives in this house, he's had the inspector out there. He's had the turnkey provider out there on a couple different occasions to fix some stuff, to replace the furnace. We got a termite inspection, the whole nine yards. This guy probably feels like, oh my goodness, like either what the hell's wrong with this house or man, this is great. They're doing all this shit to my new house that I just moved into, right? Anyway, the inspection is almost always going to pay for itself. I've never had an inspection where it came back with nothing. They've always fixed everything that has come back on the inspection, and it's money well spent. So protect yourself, protect your capital, protect your investment. Do yourself a favor, spend a couple dollars, get a fucking inspection. Okay? That's my advice there. All right. Now, next, and I alluded to this earlier, we're going to talk about why real estate is, and I did not come up with this, by the way. So, and I've seen at least two, maybe even three people talk about this acronym. I don't know where to give the credit, so I'm not taking credit for this. You may find this elsewhere, but I'm going to say that the way that I like to remember and think about this is that real estate, rental real estate, and specifically single family homes, is the quote unquote ideal investment. And I think I actually briefly talked about this with Cube Crusher on our episode. I don't know how deep I went on that. I want to say it was the cash flow investing versus growth investing episode. But anyway, we'll hit it here again. So if you look at the word ideal and use that as an acronym, where the first letter of the word ideal is going to stand for something different, the I in the word ideal is for income. And when we think about income, you know, you look at the rental income. We talked earlier about debt service. We talked about expenses, reserves, those sorts of things. When you net everything out, hopefully you have a positive number left over. That's going to be your cash flow. So when we say the letter I in the word ideal is for income, we're talking about cash flow. And I think for a lot of people, and sometimes myself included, I've gotten a little bit better about this, but when you think about real estate investing and you want to look at the whole picture, it's very easy to just say, well, this property cash flows this much. Oh, that's dog shit. Maybe I won't buy it, right? And that actually almost happened to me on this last purchase. But that's only one component of several different components when you look at the total rate of return. So hopefully you have some positive cash flow, but some people stop there. But you need to, in my opinion, dig a little bit deeper and look at the overall total return. So the I is for income. Income means cash flow. So you have that as one component. The next one, the letter D in the word ideal, would stand for depreciation. Now, we don't give tax or legal or any fucking advice on the show except to get a home inspection. That's your advice. Get a home inspection. I don't think you can really go wrong with that, right? So anyway, D for depreciation. For, you know, I think a lot of people, maybe some people know, some people don't, but depreciation, when we're talking about it in the context of real estate investing, has to do with essentially a paper loss that you can deduct that pretty much the IRS gives you on a property. So for residential property, and there's different ways to accelerate this, and there's bonus depreciation, there's a whole bunch of shit out there. So this is why you want a good tax advisor. You want a tax advisor that understands real estate investing, real estate investors, that's who their clientele is. They'll be able to do all these calculations for you and come up with the most advantageous one. But in its most basic form, right, if you look at depreciation, I'm just going to come over here. Let's say you took a house, and for round numbers, okay, I understand that you probably can't buy a shack these days for $100,000 in a lot of markets. And some, you actually can buy a house still for $100,000. But let's say you took $100,000 was your purchase price for a rental property, right? Let's say you're buying a turnkey. And let's say that the value of the building, of the actual house, was 80% of that. And the land was 20%. So $80,000 is the value of the house. And then the land has the value of $20,000 or 20%. Okay. If you take $80,000, which is the value of the property, and you use what's called straight line depreciation, and we're talking about residential real estate, and you divide by 27 and a half years, so $80,000 divided by 27.5, you come out with $2,909.09, 2909.09. So we'll just call it 2909. That is a paper loss, okay, that you can use to offset income from the property. Now, you can look at this a multitude of different ways, okay? But that is a depreciation deduction. It's not the same as a credit. Talk to your tax advisor. But let's just say somebody had an effective tax rate of, we'll call it, I don't know, 25%. Okay, so you have your estimated marginal federal brackets, which are going to be different. Then you have your effective rate. Your effective rate is always going to be less than your marginal rate. And we're not trying to do a tax lesson here, but we are digging in just a little bit. If I take this 2909 and assume I have a 25% effective tax rate, and I do the math of 2909 times 0.25 for 25%, I come out with a tangible dollar benefit of $727.27. That is another component in terms of a form of a return. you are getting a depreciation deduction. So you could have, and hopefully you do, positive cash flow on the property, but because of certain deductions, including a depreciation deduction, you can actually have positive cash flow hit your pocket, but not necessarily have to pay much, if any, taxes on it from a tax standpoint. This is why you need a good tax advisor if you're investing in real estate. So that would be the D, the depreciation deduction. Just know that there's a tax benefit there. The next letter in the word ideal would be the letter E. E would be for equity growth. Equity growth primarily due to what we call principal pay down. Every time your tenant pays rent, and every time you use that rent to pay the mortgage, assuming you have a mortgage on the property, there's going to be a portion of that that goes to principal. There's going to be a portion of that that goes to interest. And if you escrow taxes and insurance, you'll have a portion that goes to taxes and insurance. But if we just looked at the principal and the interest component, and we took, here's the rent, we're going to use that rent after, you know, all of our other expenses and property management fees and all that shit, and we're going to take that, we're going to use that money to pay the mortgage, there's a portion of that mortgage payment that is going towards the principal. And if you really want to geek out and look at it, you can go Google an amortization schedule. Let's say you had a 30-year fixed mortgage. Go out and Google 30-year fixed mortgage amortization table and put in your own numbers. And you can see at the end of the year how much went towards principal and how much went towards interest. Now, in the beginning, as you might expect, the way that these loans amortize, the majority of the payment is going to go to interest. So the portion that goes to principal is fairly small. That will continually grow over time, assuming you have, you know, a fully amortizing loan, 30-year fixed mortgage, 15-year fixed mortgage, whatever. That will go up over time in terms of the portion of the payment that goes towards the principal. But whatever it is, let's just take the first year in year one, whatever dollar amount you get, that is another form of return. Why? You basically did not make the payment. The tenant made the mortgage payment in the form of rent. You simply, it came to you, and then you redirected it to the mortgage company, the mortgage servicer, to apply that payment. But the money ultimately came from the tenant's pocket. They got up, they went to work, they got a paycheck, they paid their taxes, they paid their rent. The rent came to you. You took out, you know, the property management company takes out their fee. You put your reserves aside, whatever. And then you take whatever's left of that port and you make the mortgage payment with it, right? So that money came from them, not from your pocket. You didn't have to go to work unless your property was vacant that month and you didn't have any reserves, which hopefully never happens to you. But you're not the one consistently going out and going to work to make that mortgage payment. They are. So the portion of that that goes towards principal and pays down the principal, therefore that's where your equity growth comes from. That's coming from the tenant. That is a form of a return. So that's the E. Next is the letter A for appreciation. When I do my numbers, I use zero. And this, in a lot of cases, can sort of kill the overall total return. Because as we've seen in recent years, property values have risen substantially in most markets, if not all markets. But you can't necessarily count on that, right? You typically want to invest for cash flow and the appreciation is icing on the cake. I know there's people out there that will disagree with me. There's people that say that appreciation is where the majority of the wealth is made and yada, yada, yada. And that's a conversation for another day. But the point is, in general, most of the time, you will have some sort of appreciation. So that's another form of return. I personally assume zero, so I don't actually factor in anything for that in my calculation. But even if you took somebody that said, well, let's say that on average, appreciation was, say, 3%. The value of real estate goes up by 3% on average over long periods of time. Well, if they have a loan, they put 20% down and they get a loan, they're leveraged 5-to-1. 3% in terms of appreciation times 5-to-1 leverage is a 15% return on the money that you have invested. Remember, you did not, in most cases, pay cash for the property. You put 20% down, for example. So your returns due to leverage are magnified. So that's another form of a return. Again, I use zero, you use whatever you want. Next is the L for leverage. The fact that you can, as I just mentioned, go ahead and borrow in order to acquire the asset. You can put, for example, 20% down, right? You put 20% of the value of the property down, but you control 100% of it. And you get all these benefits that go along with owning the real estate. The bank doesn't get any of it, you do. Right? And so even if you say, well, you know, you take a look at, well, now I have debt on the property. Well, first of all, somebody else is paying that off for you over time. But even if they weren't, the value of that debt, the money that you owe, and when you pay the bank back, is you're paying them back in nominal dollars. You're not paying them back in inflation adjusted dollars. So even if, I know inflation is through the roof right now in July of 2022, but even in quote unquote normal times, if you use inflation for the past 100 years, say is around 3%, the value of that debt erodes away by, say, 3% a year. That is another form of a return for you. It's not a huge one, but it's something to keep in mind. And I think I've used this example in previous episodes about, you know, if you went to the corner store when you were a kid for whatever, 5 cents, 10 cents, you could buy a gummy bear. You can't buy shit for 5 or 10 cents now, right? Take a bottle of soda. It used to be less than a dollar. I don't know what it is now, two something. It's going to become easier and easier for you to make the same purchase, right? If you had to go back today and go to the corner store and buy a gummy bear for 10 cents, you'd laugh. You'd be like, I don't even have any change. Here's a dollar. Let me get a bunch of those fucking things, right? Same thing with soda, you know, like, oh, it's only a dollar. Well, normally this $5 bill just buys two bottles and I get a little bit of change. Let me get five bottles, right? It's easier for you to make those purchases now with the dollars that are in circulation now. And it's the same concept with the money that you owe the bank. It becomes easier and easier to make that payment. Because remember, if you have a fixed rate mortgage, especially let's say, for example, a 30-year fixed interest mortgage, your principal and interest payment is fixed for the life of the loan. So it becomes easier and easier to make that principal and interest payment as time goes on. Not to mention the fact that rents generally will go up over time. Cube Crusher and I talk about this all the time. We're gonna get him back on the show at some point, but we've been texting a lot lately and he's like, oh, you know, next lease renewal, your rents are only gonna be 75%. Of what they are now, and we have a good time. We bullshit back and forth with each other. But in general, rents will go up and do go up over time. There might be short periods of time where temporarily, if something happens, you may have to take a slight decrease. But again, that's why you have reserves, you have some margin, you have some cash flow that allows you to control the property, right? So even if your cash flow shrinks up a little bit, as long as you had positive cash flow to begin with, you're probably going to be okay and be able to weather the storm, so on and so forth. But those are the five components or profit centers or however you want to label them of rental real estate is the way that I see them and several others have seen them because, again, I didn't come up with that acronym, but that's one that's often used. Ideal investment. I, income. D, depreciation. E, equity growth. A, appreciation. And L, leverage. Ideal. I-D-E-A-L. So that is one way to calculate your returns. And depending on what numbers you use and how you calculate those, worst case scenario, including the most recent home that I purchased, which does not cash flow much really, in my opinion, at all, I think I was in the mid-teens using 0% for appreciation. There's some people that do this calculation. I've had one person came up with over 50%, which I think is a little bit generous. I would say most of the time, you're probably going to be somewhere in the mid-20s in terms of total rate of return. So even if it's just paying your cell phone bill right now, it's probably doing a lot more for you than that over the long term in your wealth building journey. So there's that. You have property management portals and reporting. So we're moving along here. Each company is going to use something a little bit different. There's a lot of software names out there that different companies might use. Some may use the same, some may not, where you can pretty much log into the portal. And for the most part, depending on the type of software they're using, I have one where I have a property management company that handles the majority of my rentals. I can log in 24/7. I could literally be on the shitter, get on my phone, log into the portal and see who pays rent. If there's any expenses, what are the expenses for? Everything is right there. It's great for reporting because they'll send you typically a year-end report. You can take that. You can give it to your tax advisor to help them with preparing your taxes. So it's really, really user-friendly there as far as that goes. Decision-making. So you will be more involved with this type of passive real estate investing than others. Because as I said at the beginning, that direct ownership gives you more control. Having more control means that you're going to be making or have the ability to make more decisions. But one in particular is what some people call managing the manager, right? You manage the property manager. So whether that's kind of nudging them to increase rents, whether that's to kind of nudge them on, okay, well, this tenant's a little bit late, what's going on? I had that happen recently. I had somebody who was in their network of properties. I have one provider that they manage, gosh, over 3,000 probably different single family homes and duplexes. And there was somebody, I had a house come vacant. They ended up moving in and they usually give you a little blurb about, you know, here's the resident situation, here's where they work, they make this, you know, many multiples of the rent, yada, yada, yada. And this particular person was a transfer from another home that they manage. And according to their standards for their transfer program, they had to have, I forget the number, but it was so many consecutive months of on-time payments, right? On-time rent payments in order to be eligible to quote unquote upgrade or move to a nicer, bigger, whatever house that they manage. And this was one of those individuals. Well, they were doing just fine for a while. They were paying like clockwork. And then all of a sudden, they weren't. And so you have to be a little bit lenient. But after so many days had gone by, finally, I kind of lit a fire under their ass. And I'm just kind of like, hey, you know, what's going on? Here's the last time we got a payment. Haven't received anything since. I just need an update. And they said, oh, you know, the tenant has been proactively communicating with us. They're having a little bit of financial trouble right now. Here's the date that they're promising to pay, so on and so forth. And so you kind of have to crack the whip sometimes on them, you know, and that's part of the deal. So it is and can be a little bit more involved from that standpoint, whereas you're not really going to be doing that, as we'll talk about in the future episodes, on the syndication side as much as you would be on the turnkey side. All right, some other pros and cons, and we'll get close to the end here. Lower risk, in my opinion, on a turnkey rental. So the rehab should already be done. The property is already stabilized. We talked about the fact that you have more control. You will have possibly multiple exit strategies, right? You could sell it to another home buyer, especially if it's a single family home, depending on the market, not just an investor. Now, if you're working with a provider that is doing duplexes, triplexes, or fourplexes, and most of them don't, but some of them do, or if they have a little bit of exposure in their portfolio to those types of rentals, you might not be selling to a home buyer. You might only be able to sell to an investor. And therefore, your returns and your metrics and your numbers may have to be that much better going in because you may have one less exit strategy coming out. So those are things to be thinking about. Better pricing. So I know that sounds kind of crazy. Like, how in the world are you getting better pricing if you're outsourcing this to a turnkey provider? And the reason is because they have economies of scale, right? The provider typically is managing hundreds, sometimes thousands of homes versus if you as an individual investor had one house, five houses, 10 houses, whatever, you're typically, unless you are handy yourself or have a good relationship with a contractor, you're gonna be paying retail pricing. You know, you gotta get a contractor to come out to your one little house, whereas some of these companies have their own employees in-house that pretty much handle all the repairs, all the maintenance. A lot of times, in some cases, and this is why I like for fully integrated turnkey companies, the people that went and did the rehab are the same people that are going out to do the repairs when needed over time, and they know exactly what was done. They know the products they use. They know what, you know, the tools, they all that stuff. They pretty much know what's going on with the property, and they can easily fix it probably a little bit easier and more cost effective than somebody else coming in from the outside, for example. And then, as I said, finally, it is fairly passive. There is a little bit of work, especially on the front end. You got to vet the provider. If you want to, you got to visit the provider. Then you got to, you know what zip code you want to be in. What type of house do you want? Then you got to go under contract now. You got to deal with a lender if you're going to finance it. And then, you know, you got to sign your property management agreement. You got to do all that shit. But once that's done on the front end, typically it's fairly passive on the back end, which kind of goes with my mantra of I want to do something once and get paid forever. Now, is it 100% passive and hands off? No. But I feel like it's fairly close to that. You know, you don't spend a ton of time on maintaining, if you will. That's what you're hiring them to do. The cons. So with turnkey rental investments, specifically single family rentals, there is little to no equity capture on the buy. You'll hear a lot of real estate investors say you make your money on the buy. Well, those are typically people that are going to do the rehab themselves. They found the distressed property themselves. There's some equity up for grabs there that they want to try to capture. You know, they can basically do the value add and force that appreciation, and they can make some of their money that way. That's not what you're doing with turnkey. Somebody is pretty much, the analogy I like to use is it's kind of like going out for dinner and ordering a steak. I could go down the street to the grocery store and buy a steak and cook it myself and do all that shit and pay less, or I can go out, I can have a great experience, right? I can pay a little bit extra, and when they serve me the steak and they hand me the bill, I'm gonna pay multiples more for that than I am if I cooked it myself, but I would rather go out and have that experience going out to eat and then not have to wash dishes and not have to cut the steak and grill the steak and do all that shit myself and just enjoy. And so, you know, just like somebody handing you a steak at a restaurant, right, in a nice fancy restaurant, they kind of hand you a property on a silver platter where all the rehab work has already been done for you. So that is a con though. There's little to no equity capture on the buy, right? The value has already been extracted by the provider. So you can say that's a downside. The owner is responsible for all maintenance and repairs, right? CapEx, all the things we talked about as far as reserves go. So if you have multiple properties, you now have multiple roofs, you have multiple HVACs, etc. So, you know, you're gonna need some liquidity as far as that goes to handle those things. And different people do this differently. When I first started investing and kind of still do this, I have a separate account for every single property where I hold reserves. And you could say, well, there's some cash drag there. And I would tell you that I sleep really well at night. And, you know, other people will say that, well, you know, you could take 3-5% of the value of your overall portfolio, whatever the market value of your total real estate portfolio is, and hold that in something that's liquid like cash. There's some people that do that, and they may not have a separate account for every single property. I'm kind of still experimenting with this. Like I said, I've been invested in real estate now for maybe a half a dozen years or so, but you know, you slowly kind of figure things out as you go. But that's one thing that seems to work well for me. And I like seeing that compartmentalized. I can log in and I can see each reserve account and how much is in there. Kind of gives you an indication of your properties that may have more maintenance requests than others and kind of what that looks like. And so there's different ways to do that. But again, a con would be that you do have to maintain a certain amount of liquidity to handle anything that may come up, right? And that's just part of the deal. Of my quote unquote passive investments, I will tell you that turnkey single family rental properties are probably the least passive. Right? There's others that are significantly more passive. And we'll talk in future episodes about some of those, but there's different types of turnkey. So we've talked almost exclusively in this episode about turnkey single family rental properties. And that's going to be the vast majority when somebody says turnkey rentals, that's probably what they're talking about. But keep in mind that there are other types of turnkey investments that aren't necessarily syndications or funds. You can have direct ownership of other types of assets, right? So you can, for example, get involved, and there's a bunch of groups out there that do different types of turnkey agricultural real estate investments, right? Where, you know, you could own coffee, you could own cacao, you could own oranges, you could own vacation rentals. That vacation rentals aren't agricultural, obviously, but you could, you know, you could pretty much invest in anything that you want to and have something that is turnkey, passively managed. You have direct ownership, right? Things are deeded to you, whether it's a parcel that's deeded to you or an actual property that's deeded to you or whatever, that you have that direct ownership and control. There's more than just the single family rentals. There's different types of agricultural investments out there where you can have direct ownership as well. So that's all I have today in episode 23 on turnkey rentals. Next time I am going to do an episode on syndications and funds. And I was able to secure a guest for the episode after that. So O-Dog is coming on the show. Shout out to him. Heads up that that's coming. That should be a good one. And until next time, we will see you in the next episode.
Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.